أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome once again to Islam in Focus. Today's program will be our 42nd on our series Jesus, the Beloved Messenger of Allah. It's our 9th on Trinity, Atonement and Blood Sacrifice. And our topic today will be on crucifixion. I'm your host, Ashad Mimish, and here once again from St. Mary's University is Dr. John Vedoli. Assalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How about a short summary, please, of last week's program?
Sure. Last week, we continued discussion or analysis of the concept of atonement as presented by Paul. We indicated that there's a problem with timing. Why did atonement take place 2,000 years ago, not before or after? We also discussed the fate of those who died before Jesus was born and the theological difficulties faced in answering that question by Christian theologians, and how finally many of them concluded that believing in the blood atonement of Jesus may not necessarily be the sole and only universal way of salvation for all. We also indicated that there is no reason to defend Paul's theory of atonement, because God could have forgiven and could forgive mankind anytime directly without having to go through any roundabout ways of doing it. We also confirmed that by referring to some Christian scholars who themselves admitted that blood sacrifice was not an absolute necessity for God's forgiveness and showing of his love and mercy. And we indicated that from the practical standpoint, the blood sacrifice of Jesus, peace be upon him, did not really remove the effect of original sin in view of Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 through 19, because the world is still going as it is. That even if we look at it as giving power to overcome sin, we notice that there are those who believed in the concept of atonement, even popes, but committed sin. And there are those who did not believe in the atonement, and also they repented and had very good and major change in their lives, which means that believing in that theory of giving power is independent really of what actually happens with people who believed or not believed in the, or did not believe in this particular doctrine. But all of that again was on the assumption that Jesus was indeed crucified. Mm-hmm. And that itself even is subject to more careful examination question.
Well, thank you. Now let's start with our new topic, and maybe we'll begin by asking you about the suggestion that all those who believe in Jesus mm-hmm. unanimously accept the crucifixion.
Well, to start with, I beg to make a slight correction in that assumption, which mm-hmm. is, as you said, is quite common, that all those who believed in Jesus unanimously believed in his crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is at least 1 billion human beings, 1,000 million human beings, who believe in Jesus, love him, respect him, but not as God or divine Son of God, and exactly, and do not believe in that he was crucified. These are the Muslims. And their authority comes from what they believe to be the word of God, the Quran, in Surah Al-Nisa, that's number 4, in verses 157 and 158. It says it clearly that while there was already a conspiracy to kill Jesus or to crucify him, it says they killed him not, nor did they crucify him, but it appeared to them as such, or it was made to appear to them. And then later on, it says God raised him unto himself. Now, this might sound right, just all right, that's only the Muslim position, that Jesus was not the one who was put on the cross. But as we indicated in some earlier programs in this series, in the early Christianity, there were several sects, not one, at least 7 sects, who believed that Jesus was not crucified, and they believed in the so-called substitutionary theory, that someone else in his place actually is the one who died on the cross. And this includes, just to name a few, the Corinthians, the early Basilians, the Vessalians, the Carpocrates, the Nazarites, and others. Furthermore, when the gospel, according to Barnabas, who was a contemporary of Jesus, an eyewitness, was discovered in Austria several hundreds of years ago, it also indicates that Jesus was not crucified, that the angel carried him away, and that God changed the face of Judah the Iscariot, who betrayed him, and he looked like Jesus, and he was arrested and actually crucified with the understanding that he was Jesus by way of punishment for his betrayal, but it was not Jesus. In a previous program early in the series also, we indicated that a more recent discovery, the scrolls of Najah Hammadi in Egypt, which was published or made available in English for the first time in 1977, shows also quite clearly that Jesus was not crucified, and actually he was watching the crucifixion. Now, so the idea here is that it is not just a Muslim position, that the idea of unanimity, even among Christians, if we take early Christian sects, even though some of them classified them as heretics, but, you know, of course, we discussed that early history, what was the criteria of being heretical or orthodox. But the interesting part in all of that, that all of these stories or these groups, whether they are the all the Muslims on one hand or the early Christian sects, they believed in some kind of substitutionary theory. According to the Quran, it says it was made to appear to them. So something happened. Somebody was put already on the cross, killed on the cross, but it was not Jesus. And in fact, you can examine that issue either from the standpoint of what is the degree of consistency of the story about the crucifixion as it is found in the four Gospels, or you can examine it also from the standpoint of whether the crucifixion was in fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies. On the second issue, I found an interesting study by Ahmad Abdul Wahab in his book, which again is not in English, so I just give the translation. It says Christ in the sources, in Christian sources, was published in Cairo in 1978. And the book in turn actually is based on Christian theologian. He gave a list of all of the Christian theological works which he used to that, including people with such repute among biblical scholars such as Dennis Nyhan, Fenton, Grant, Dodd, and Adolf Harnack. A part which is particularly interesting with respect to the question of crucifixion and prophecies about it, if any, is the one that deals with the analysis of the Psalms of David.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Could you tell me the basic premises in analyzing the prophecies in Psalms?
Well, the basic premises, which I suppose apply to the analysis of any religious book, or particularly the Old Testament, or any books that might carry any prophecy, is that in many cases you cannot really interpret those prophecies literally, word for word. The Bible contains lots of proverbs and allegories, and you have to take the general meaning, unless, of course, there is reason to believe that it has to be taken literally. So it's not always just a literal meaning. There is allegories many times. Secondly, in the case of the Psalms of David in particular, we find that there is repeated prayers and supplication of a righteous servant of God was praying earnestly to God to save him from his enemies and saving him from death. Of course, it doesn't mean natural death here. It means premature, violent death, because everybody would have to face natural death anyway, so you don't pray to be saved from that. The other aspect about the approach also is that he says that many times some biblical scholars or evangelists make reference to the Psalms of David as an evidence to show that the crucifixion of Jesus and his trial were already prophesied long time ago. And he says, well, if this is the case, then those references, those Psalms, must be consistent in giving that picture that it was Jesus actually who was crucified. And he says, on the contrary, if you examine some of those frequently referred to Psalms, you will find, in fact, that if you take it as a whole, it shows that Jesus will be saved from the cross in the most critical moment. In some of the even some of those Psalms, even it may indicate that someone else even will be crucified in his place.
Let's analyze a few of these prophecies, in particular those that claim to refer to the crucifixion of Jesus. Maybe you can just start off with some examples.
Okay, I'll try again to be as fair as I can and not just giving counter evidence. I'll try to be fair also by presenting the evidence normally presented in this respect. Maybe not necessarily everything, but I'll try my best. But it has been noted that many evangelists and biblical scholars keep repeating or referring to the Psalms of David, Psalm number 22. And this is not new, because other gospel writers also made reference to that particular psalm, at least 22 as it appears in our presently available copies of the Bible. We find that Mark, for example, the writer of the gospel, referred to it in chapter 15, Matthew in chapter 6 and 27, Luke in chapter 23, John in chapter 14, whoever wrote the book of Hebrews, possibly Paul, in chapter 2 and in chapter 5. Now, let me give one of the basic evidences that they present as predicting exactly what happened. In the very first verse of that Psalm 22, it says, God, God, why have you forsaken me? I'm sure for many of our friends among the viewers, the first thing that clicks to mind is the words attributed to Jesus on the cross, exactly the same words, God, God, why have you forsaken me? That has been quoted in Matthew chapter 27 and in Mark in chapter 15. Now, another or additional point even that I noted that may be presented as an argument for the prophecy about crucifixion is that in verses 6 to 8 of the Psalm 22, it speaks about someone who is scorned, mocked at by others, and he's told that, you know, he's committed to God, let God save him. And again, many would immediately connect that with the gospel according to Matthew chapter 27, that Jesus was scorned and despised, you know, at the time when he was taken to be crucified. We notice also that the psalm speaks about a person whose enemies are going to divide his garment and cast lots on his raiments. And some would say, listen, this is exactly what Matthew said in chapter 27, especially verse 35. In verse 14, that person complains that his bones are out of joint and that it could be counted. And they say, well, this definitely applies to the crucifixion, because the body is hung, so you can really count your ribs. And more interestingly, even in verse 16, that person is crying and he says that they pierced my hands and my feet, which they say that's an obvious reference to crucifixion. While it might sound quite interesting and might sound a very clear analogy between the wording of that psalm and the story of crucifixion as described in the Gospels, it is totally out of context. Not according to Muslims, but according to such respected biblical scholars like Dennis Meinham and others. Why? That psalm actually does not describe something that will happen in the future, but it actually describes something that already has happened in the past, and it has been referred to in the Old Testament, especially in the First Samuel in chapter 27 and chapter 30 also, First Chronicle in chapter 12. To be very brief, it describes the trial of David and his conflict with Saul, the first king of Israel. And in the beginning, when he says, God, God, why have you forsaken me? Actually, he's really crying in a period of very grave difficulty and danger that threatened him. That is why he describes his situation and say that the bulls of Bashan has surrounded me, to express his extreme distress and the enemies surrounding him. Definitely he describes that his bones are out of joint. Of course, when you're afraid, when you're really in a distressful situation, you can't express that your bones are out of joints. He also describes in addition that his strength has already dried. And according to historians, this is when this happened, when the Amalekites invaded the city of Ziklag. They burned the whole city. They took the women and girls as captives, including the two wives of two of the David's wives. At that time, the people of Ziklag were very angry and very sad, and all of them, including David, of course, were crying until, according to the Bible, they could not cry anymore. And some people were so mad, even against David himself. They thought that David brought all this misfortune to them. They thought that they should stone David. It is under these circumstances that David was distressed and crying and seeking the help of God. Those who wish to check that, for example, in a very brief way, you can refer to the first book of Samuel in chapter 30, verses 1 to 6, where there's a very prolific description of the kind of distress through which David was going. Now, with this kind of background, with this kind of historical event, then David, when he says, God, why have you forsaken me? I am scorned and despised because people wanted to stone him. When he says that they cast lots, well, it was known among the Israelites, according to the book of Numbers in chapter 26, especially verse 56, that this is what they did, that when they take the war booty, they cast lots on it. The description of garment might be also an allegory of women, because if you go back to the book of Genesis in chapter 2, verse 23, the woman or the wife is described as the flesh of my flesh, almost in like a garment. So they cast lots on the wives of David and the possession of other people of the city of Ziklag. In brief, then, the psalm has nothing to do with the future. It simply describes an actual historical event which has already taken place in the life of David according to the books of the Old Testament itself.
Dr. Bell, that's a very complete and very good answer. But the term pierce my hands and feet seemed to refer to crucifixion. Mm-hmm. And David was not crucified. Okay. Now, are we misinterpreting or misunderstanding the expression here?
I don't think so, because you see, when you use the term or expression, they pierced my hands and feet, which is an expression of great pain. It need not necessarily be literal, as indicated earlier. As you mentioned before, it is not the first time that the Bible used some of these allegories. This is simply an allegory to express pain. Ahmad Abdul Wahab, for example, in page 231, gives an example elsewhere from the Bible. In the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 28, verse 13, we find that God purportedly is threatening the Israelites that if they continue to disobey him, that the heavens above them will be brass and the earth underneath them will become iron. Well, at no time was the sky turned into brass or the earth turned into iron, not according to the Bible, even though the Israelites continued to disobey God. So again, it need not necessarily be literal in that sense. But even if we take piercing hands and feet in the literal sense that they pierced my hands and my feet, it applies again to the extreme suffering of Prophet David because of the invasion of the Amalekites. What piercing more could you expect you know, when the women and the children are taken captives by the invading army. But what is more important than all of that is the term pierced. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting to notice that in the original Hebrew version, the word pierced does not exist.
It does not exist.
In fact, instead of that, it says like a lion, but it doesn't say pierced. Any viewer who has an access to the revised standard version of the Bible may verify that. You check Psalms of David, number 22, verse 16. And you notice that there is under pierced, in front of pierced, there is a footnote, number M, like mother, which explained that and say that this is not the term or the wording in the original Hebrew. Now, this kind of understanding or explanation is not an explanation of someone who is outside of Christianity. The famous Christian theologian Dennis Nyhan, in his book St. Mark, also agrees with that, and he says that this Psalm 22 is simply an earnest prayer of a righteous servant of God who is really suffering, but who is meanwhile confident of the love of God, that God will protect him and save him. I believe that what Nyhan, as a biblical scholar, say makes a great deal of sense for two reasons. One, if you take the same psalm as a whole and check verse number 24, it shows clearly that God listened and responded favorably to the prayer of that person. It reads, he has not hid, that's God has not hid face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. Of course, God hearing doesn't just hearing and ignoring, means heard in a sense of responded by saving him at the moment of distress. The second reason, if you look into verse 26, it also emphasizes that the afflicted will eat and be satisfied, and it speaks also about praising the Lord as a result of that. That could hardly apply to someone who died on the cross. See? So what we're saying basically that psalm, obviously, even though there might be some interesting similarity in wording, but the context is quite different. It doesn't refer in any way to some future event, less so the crucifixion of Jesus, because that salvation that verses 24 and 6 speak about actually stand in clear contrast and opposition to what Paul said in his letter to the Romans in chapter 8, verse 32, when he said, he that God did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. But the son doesn't say that. It says that the man will be saved. God will deliver him.
Dr. Jamal, is there any other psalm which is presented as a prophecy of the crucifixion?
Well, there are several. But the problem, again, with some evangelists in particular, like Josh McDowell and others, they go through the psalm and just find any word, any expression that resembles in any way, even remote, the story of crucifixion according to the gospel and say, hey, you know, this is prophecy, a clear prophecy about. But they don't take the totality of the psalm and what happens to those people who purportedly were praying to God. Take an example, the 31st psalm. Verse 5 is quite interesting because the person who's praying says, into thy hand I commit my spirit. Into thy hand I commit my spirit. And say, look, this is identical to what Jesus said on the cross in the gospel according to Luke chapter 23, verse 46. He said exactly the same thing when he was dying on the cross. I'd like to add also, again, in the spirit of trying to be fair and give even the supporting evidence of what I don't believe in, but just to be fair in presenting the other view. When I read it also, I found that you could still also argue, if you were picking and choosing, that this person who was praying to God will be a scorn for his enemies and adversaries, in verse 11, that those who will see him in the street will run away from him. And we could say, yes, this is what happened. Jesus, you know, was alone, he was scorned, and his disciples even ran away from him. They were afraid. That it says that the enemies are plotting to take his life in verse 13. And we could go on and say, all right, yeah, there are some similarities there. Now, if we were to take this Psalm 31 through this method of picking and choosing the parts that suits the crucifixion, then we can also find ample evidence that righteous servant who was crying and seeking the help of God and deliverance was indeed saved and not crucified. There are a number of reasons, and again it's based on the same Psalm. One, in verses 1 and 17, it indicates that that fellow or that servant who is praying to God, he's praying never to put him to shame, never to put him to shame. And let us remember that the greatest shame among the Israelites is to be hanged on a tree.
Mm-hmm.
According to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 21, verse 23, they consider anyone in that position as cursed. What could be more shame than that? Secondly, he is praying to God to deliver him from the hands of his enemies and his persecutors, in verse 15. He is also indicating or praying to God to take him, notice here, out of the net which is hidden for him. Verse 4, the net that was hidden for him could possibly mean the kiss of Judah, who betrayed him. All right. In verse 17 also, it shows that God will put, that the wicked will be put to shame. Could that possibly be a reference that the shame intended originally for Jesus by crucifixion actually was put on Judah and he was crucified in his place? But what is more important than all of that, because you can argue it both ways, is that it is impossible for someone who is a sincere servant of God, let alone a person with high status and stature like Jesus, peace be upon him, that he will be rejected by God. And this is precisely what the verses 7 and 8 of that psalm indicate. Let me quote it. It says, I will, that sincere servant prays and says, I will rejoice and be glad for thy steadfast love, because thou hast seen my affliction, thou hast taken heed of my adversities. See, mm-hmm. He says that God has already taken heed of his adversities and has not delivered me into the hands of my enemies.
You
saved me.
You saved me.
You see, from the cross. So if we take the Psalm 31 as a whole, we will find that if it applies to Jesus, or if we assume that it applies to Jesus, it means that God responded to him, did not deliver him to his enemies, put the shame on those who plotted against him, Judah, and that Judah was the one who was put on the cross, and not Jesus.
That's very interesting. The suggestion that it was Judah who may have possibly been crucified in the place of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other collaborating prophecies to this effect?
Yes, indeed. First of all, we have mentioned already in the discussion of the ninth Psalm of David, especially verses 3, 5, and 6,
mm-hmm.
that the righteous servant speaks about the destruction of his enemies and saving him from the gates of death, that is, in the most critical moment. We have seen that in the analysis of Psalm number 31. We find it also in numerous others. Take one, for example, Psalm number 34. Again, it says, let the afflicted be glad. See? It talks also about God answering the prayers of that afflicted person. In verse 6, it says that God saved him and that the angels encamps the person who fears God. And that's quite interesting, because in the Gospel, according to Barnabas, it says that the angels
mm-hmm.
took Jesus away and mm-hmm. saved him from being put on the cross. I noted also that in verse 20 of Psalm 34, it says that God will protect or preserve all his bones, not in the sense that John said in chapter 19, verse 34, but to say that God saved him, mm-hmm. that not even a bone was broken means not that the soldiers did not break his leg, but it means that he will be saved intact. And this is only some of many.
Well, thank you very much. We seem to have run out of time. This is just fascinating. Thank you all for joining us here in Islam in Focus. As always, your questions and comments would be most appreciated. Our phone number and our address will be appearing on your screen. From all of us here in Islam in Focus, Assalamu alaikum.
أشهد أن محمدا رسول